Sometime in June 1303, a ship sailed down the River Thames. It was a small ship, and bore markings that indicated it had, until recently, been serving King Edward I up north, conducting his war against the Scottish. The ship may have docked at Bishopsgate Dock, but probably sailed on, under London Bridge, past the city's western edge, the newly built and still not fully completed Blackfriars Monastery. It travelled onwards up the Thames, past the Crusader compounds, off the White Friars next door to the headquarters of the Knights Templar, past the large houses that ran along the riverside, including the newly reinforced, not quite a fortress of the King's brother, the Savoy, and it sailed around the bend in the river, to Westminster, the heart of the royal government in the city. This ship was carrying a letter, one addressed to one of the king's most trusted men in the city, from King Edward himself. And the letter was extraordinary. It said, quote, "We have accepted and learnt from the testimony of faithful and loyal people that certain malefactors and disturbers of our peace have, by force of arms, broken into our treasury within Westminster and have taken out and carried elsewhere a great part of our treasure deposited in the aforesaid place, and have committed terrible crimes in clear contempt of us and inestimable damage against our peace." Unquote. Yep, someone or someones had raided the great treasury of the most feared king in medieval English history. Someone had stolen the crown jewels. The king's fury at this act can be guessed at by the tone and wording of this terrible letter, which continued, quote, "We, wishing a hasty remedy to this, have assigned you to inquire on oath to discover who are the malefactors, who knew about the robbery, who offered and gave the robbers help, counsel, and assistance, who knowingly received the said treasure, how was the said treasure taken, and how much, in whose hand is the treasure now, as well as all other circumstances surrounding said robbery, and do whatever is necessary to elucidate the full truth in this matter," unquote. Oh, this was bad. The crime was bad, but the king's anger would be brutal. The letter concludes, quote, "Therefore we command you that you make a full inquiry, and that all who are guilty of this deed, or who have helped and advised on it, or received the said treasure, be arrested without delay, and be kept safe and secure in our prison until we have reached a decision on this matter. Whatever treasure is found in the hands of these malefactors, you must deposit it in a safe and secure place, in accordance with our instructions. Know that we have instructed our sheriffs in London, Middlesex, and Surrey to arrange to bring as many knights and upright men as is needed, so you can establish more clearly the truth," unquote. King Edward was not pissing about. The entire power and majesty and weight of the legal authorities of the state were about to come down on this crime. It was the most audacious robbery of royal treasure ever carried out. That treasury of the king at Westminster didn't just contain coins. There were holy relics in there. The Cross of Neath, the Black Holy Cross of St. Margaret from Scotland, the Rod of Moses. It had the sword of King Æthelstan from the 9th century, the sword of Waylon the Smith, which was last used to make a knight out of Henry II. It had the sword of the mythical Prince Tristan, which had been presented to King John by the Holy Roman Emperor. It also contained important personal possessions of the king, including the dagger used in an attempt to assassinate him whilst he'd been on crusade in the Holy Land. All these items were surrounded by most of the royal regalia of the Crown of England, as well as jewels, silver and gold, coins, goblets, jugs, chalices, cups, saucers, spoons and vases. It was filled with treasure, both family and personal. And it had just been plundered. All hell was about to break loose in London. Hi, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, an attempt to tell the history of the city as one huge, long narrative tale. And we've reached a part of the tale where we include the story of this epic robbery and what happened and who did it and how it dominated the affairs of London for the next few months and how this robbery opens up for us an insight to London's seedy underbelly at the start of the 14th century. Welcome to a slice of life involving criminal monks, corrupt city officials, elaborate sting operations, and how the lines between respectable London oligarchs and dodgy criminal types were often wafer thin. Welcome then to chapter 109 of the story, and the first part of a two-parter known as the Westminster Job. This is the Great Robbery. So when I was writing this podcast, at first I didn't really know how to pitch it. I mean, should I do it like one of those ever so popular true crime podcasts that everybody seems to love? That would be awesome. I mean, we don't have a murder, but we do have a robbery. So how do I explain things as they go down? Perhaps I present to you the details as the investigators discovered them. Allow you follow the trail about who was responsible. I don't know if I can do that, but I know. Let's just start with the scene of the crime. The royal treasury was not kept in the palace of Westminster. It was being kept at the time next door, in Westminster Abbey. In the early 1290s, Westminster Abbey had been chosen as a place to store the royal treasure. 30 years earlier, Henry III had finished building the splendid chapter house off the abbey, with its massive central pillar soaring up to its concave roof. Well lit by windows, it was very pretty. Now, the Benedictine monks who had lived there already had their own treasury, the Picts Chamber, along the East Cloister. The Picts was a part of the original undercroft of the old 11th century church and lay just beneath the monks' dormitory. Part of this undercroft had been walled up and used as a security room, with only one entrance protected by a massive door with six locks. There is no doubt that both the Crown and the Abbey used the chapel of the Picts, or the Picts Chamber, to store valuables and documents, especially the latter. The Picts Chamber was very secure, although its outside windows overlooked a blind spot, a secluded place near the infirmary. But because of this, many later historians ended up thinking that it was in the Picts Chamber where the royal treasure was stored and where the robbery took place. However, this is not the case. The evidence from all the accounts, as well as even a contemporary drawing of the robbery, clearly indicates that the treasury was in the crypt below everything, which in fact was an ideal strong room. The crypt lay beneath the new chapter house. Its floor is about 30 feet in diameter. The walls were 17 to 18 feet thick in places. Entrance through the roof was impossible and clearly open to detection. The windows of the crypt were very small and narrow and were probably covered by bars reinforced by metal plates and stout wooden shutters and maybe even slabs of concrete. Still, as with the Chapel of the Picts, these windows constituted the only Achilles heel in the design. Access to the crypt was only along a narrow passageway from the Abbey Church near the sacristy. You had to go through stout doors and then down some steep steps, some of whom were deliberately built missing. So you had to actually lumber with a set of wooden stairs to make the stairway down to the crypt work. The actual door to the crypt was thick and reinforced, its keys held by important wardrobe officials. The crypt had been specially paved by the mason John Le Converse, and inside the crypt was a further security measure. The squat central pillar that held it all up was used as a strongbox. Part of this very thick stone column were ingeniously carved out to form secret recesses in which there were other recesses, and valuables could be stored within it and then concealed by inserting the missing slabs of stone over it. It was one heck of a safe place. As well as this, the thick walls and narrow fortified access were also enhanced by, well, the sacred nature of this place. Westminster Abbey was the crown's own chapel. It was the kingdom's most prestigious church. It was the shrine of the patron saint of England, Edward the Confessor. It was the mausoleum of royalty. It was the place of holy coronation. It was sacred. Any thief who decided to rob that place would probably incur excommunication for violating it and would be cursed by bell, book and candle in all his doings and actions. It would mean he was denied Christian burial and damned to the fires of hell for all eternity. And the king's lawyers would also argue that theft from such a place actually constituted treason. The guilty party would be hunted down and killed like a dog, or if they're unlucky to be arrested, they'd suffer the full rigours of the horrendous punishment of the crime of treason. However, the initial investigation suggested that access to this chamber had been gained. It had been robbed. And access had been gained via one of the small windows, apparently. Now, obviously, breaking through a window that was so small required the entire frame to be removed. And something like that should have been seen. But the initial report said the thieves had very cunningly planted hemp seeds in the ground some months beforehand. The hemp had grown into a series of large bushes, and these bushes supposedly obscured the window and allowed the thieves to break in and do the robbery without detection. It doesn't take a genius to work out that if the thieves had been that cunning, it was probably done by criminals who knew exactly what they were aiming for. In other words, they knew the layout of this place, and they knew how to manipulate it. People who lived very locally. That means the culprits probably came from the surrounding town of Westminster. We need to take a second to describe Westminster in the year 1303. It was a strange place. To get there, you left London, walked down Fleet Street, and then you took a left at the newly built Charing Cross Cenotaph to the King's late wife Eleanor. Once you'd done that, you found yourself travelling down King Street. And that would be located just outside the building that would become known as York Palace. Beyond there, King Street became Royal Way. Further down Royal Way, you would pass over a stream that still remained, delineating one part of the waterways that had designated this entire region an island, and eventually came to the complex that Westminster was based upon. To your left, the gate into the palace yard, the way to Westminster Palace. But ahead would be a side gate into the abbey, and beyond that, St. Margaret's Church, the parish church to the lay members of the abbey population. But if you ignored these two gates, turned right and carried along the street that ran alongside the great wall around the abbey, a street known as Thieving Lane, I'm not kidding, you would eventually come to the great gatehouse entrance to the abbey, a huge structure that contained the abbey's actual jail. So that was Westminster. But the heart of Westminster was the abbey, the very structure upon which the crypt was built over. And that begs the question, if it was done by a local, could this have been an inside job? I know it sounds silly, but well, on paper, no. This was a Benedictine abbey. The monks lived draconian lives, strictly monitored and regulated. The abbot, a man called Walter Wenlock, wrote pages and pages of rules and regulations for these monks to follow, regulations to obey, all of which were designed to make sure the monks were focused entirely upon their devotions to the Almighty. So on paper, one would say no. However, Abbot Walter Wenlock was a man guilty of several sins, and the first one seems to have been the crime of nepotism. Of course, as we've established in many episodes previously, nepotism was the default setting of all men in power at this time. As we have shown, St. Paul's Cathedral over in London was famed for how important officials would make sure their families would find lucrative prebendary positions. Church office was, not just here in Westminster Abbey, but all across England, very much a family affair. Abbot Wenlock was simply no exception. While he held the position of abbot here, he was still closely linked to his childhood parish up in Shropshire. He used a high-ranking monk of the order here, Alexander de Penshaw, to buy his mother property around Ellesmere. We started seeing relatives of his appearing in the abbey records. At least three monks arrived, all bearing the surname Wenlock. And in 1296, Alexander de Penshaw was ordered to pay a considerable sum of 20 shillings from the abbey treasury to one Father John de Wenlock. The abbot sent great sums of money to his mother, and round about 1289 to 1290, the abbot's mother herself, Lady Agnes, travelled in great pomp to Westminster, where she was given more money and gifts. The old lady stayed at Westminster for months, being royally entertained along with other relatives, with feastings and minstrels. Such a state of affairs continued for the next 8 years, until the old lady died round about 1298. However, even though his mother was gone, Abbot Walter simply turned both his resources and those of the abbey towards other family members, including his sister. So yes, he was guilty of nepotism. And also, well, I don't want to say anything, but he lavished a lot of money and attention upon a so-called cousin, an attractive young woman called Christine de Evesham, who was brought up to Westminster and given lodgings nearby. Expensive lodgings. Cousin. Yeah, that's the term we're using. She was his cousin. But she wasn't always there. She would seem to follow Abbot Wenlock as he travelled. Wenlock was an absentee abbot, it seemed, enjoying life with his young and coincidentally a quite attractive and nubile cousin. Such nepotism, hypocrisy and largesse made Abbot Walter de Wenlock vulnerable and open to possible blackmail. Keep that thought in mind. Abbot Walter Wenlock had ruled the St. Peter's Abbey of Westminster for about 25 years when the robbery took place. And while he had written up long, detailed and strict instructions as to how things should be run, it was clear he was rarely ever there to enforce the rules. And while he was away, there seemed to have been a divergence in how the abbey was actually being run. Certain members of his community seemed to eat and drink very well. They were whispered to consort with women of the night. They used the ancient rites of the abbey to harbour felons and outlaws. They fraternised with shady characters. They were heavily suspected in robbing silver intended for the requiem masses of the late queen. This sounds like a bunch of guys who may have been involved in such terrible activities such as plundering the royal treasury. Who were these monks, and were they as criminal as the rumours suggested they were? The investigations into the grand theft would subsequently show that this theft may have been part of a pattern. Abbot Wenlock, the man in charge of the abbey, was the kind of man who would issue detailed and strict instructions about the exact positioning of the cushions in his hall, but couldn't notice how between November 1302 and June 1303 that the silver from his own refectory had gone missing. Okay, who should have if he was not around? Well, the abbot's duties were management. The practical running of the abbey should have been overseen by the prior of the abbey. It was discovered, however, that the prior at the time, William de Huntingdon, was a overlooked figure, weak and feckless, unable even to prevent, or so rumour had it, some of his brothers consorting with ladies of the night in the gardens. True power in the abbey seemed to lie with Abbot Walter's friend and colleague from the Midlands, Alexander de Pershaw, who in 1303, when the robbery took place, held the office of sub-prior. Alexander de Pershaw had come to preeminence in 1284, when he'd accompanied Abbot Wenlock to Rome. Now, regular listeners, if you remember back in chapter 96, at the start of that chapter, I told the story of Prior Philip of Westminster Abbey, who'd become abbot, but because he was so fat and content, he didn't want to make that journey to Rome to have his position confirmed, and so sent monks to do it for him. Well, 30 or so years later, Wenlock had made the journey, and Alexander de Pershaw had come with him. Once Wenlock returned as abbot, Alexander de Pershaw emerged as a power in the abbey, securing loans for the abbot, buying land for the abbot's mother, as we said, holding the office of sacristan, and then keeper of the abbot's household, almoner, receiver and envoy to Rome. He appears to have been the link between Abbot Wenlock and his community of monks, and between the community and the outside world. It was also discovered that, as well as this, he was also the link to a whole legion of rather unsavoury characters found in and around Westminster. You see, the abbey, despite its high walls, was not cut off from the town of Westminster. Indeed, the state of Westminster is crucial to understand how this story plays out. The town itself had expanded, with properties built all along King Street, the Royal Way, Thieving Lane and beyond. The Palace of Westminster was the seat of the royal government, which meant that all the officials who worked there would need houses or tenements, rooms or chambers, which meant that there'd been a heck of a property boom. Of course, such a property explosion and an increase with the number of people there meant that, well, these people would also require inns, taverns, cookshops and bakeries to supply them. And these in turn attracted swarms of tradesmen, who in turn needed servants and workers. So the stream of retainers in and out of the palace and of the region expanded rapidly. And such sudden growth, wealth and power would also attract other sorts of people. Thieves, pimps, prostitutes, all the shades of nearby London's seedy underworld. Westminster offered rich pickings to such people, especially as this boomtown enjoyed its rights free of London's interference. Henry III had little love for London, but he lavished affection, as well as a torrent of silver, on his own foundation here in Westminster. Henry III also made it clear that London should not interfere with the liberties of the Abbey or Westminster town. He wanted London to have nothing to do with it. And the community had in its own way thrived. I mean, the overall economy had been helped by small fairs that took place every Monday, as well as the Great Fair of St. Edward the Confessor, which opened every October. Accordingly, Westminster Abbey and town lay beyond the Bar of London. Such a small yet teeming little community with its varied population was hardly, however, a shrine of peace and calm. Violence was commonplace on its crowded streets. For decades it was known as a place of sudden and violent murder, of hidden criminality. This was a town of dark nights in cramped lodgings, of criminals carrying out their villainy unchecked, and how the law depended solely on eyewitness evidence. If no one saw anything, no one could ever be convicted. Beyond the Bar of London, Westminster swarmed with landless men and women, a shifting population of good and bad. This is the macabre atmosphere that pervades this great robbery. Westminster was a place where villainy was perpetuated so brazenly that innocent folk could only hide and watch. And in the midst of all of this, Westminster Abbey did little to help the situation, or perhaps even made it worse with the protection they offered with its sanctuary. Here, according to the law and ancient usage, criminals fleeing the law from elsewhere could find shelter, and provided they stayed here, they would be protected under church law. They would eventually have to leave the country, but the right of sanctuary was pretty ancient. The Sanctuary of Westminster dated back at least to the Abbacy of Gilbert Crispin in the 12th century. And if you remember, I actually discussed the effects of having so many criminals in Westminster all the way back in chapter 56. Such close proximity as the sanctuary of the Abbey to a town already packed with people who were looking for employment or were willing to make money provided everybody else looked the other way. Yeah, this was a dangerous mixture. Little wonder that when the authorities, in the aftermath of the great robbery, did a swoop on Westminster in June 1303, they would find hiding there a former priest and professional church breaker, a Lincolnshire man called John de Rippenhale, who is just fresh from his most recent exploits robbing churches in Woolnoth. And they'd also find someone called John Le Rishi, supposedly a servant at the Abbey, who in another life was an outlaw from Bedfordshire called John Ramage. Some of the Benedictine monks of this abbey then had lately, it seemed, began to move easily amidst such neighbours. They did business with them. They even recruited them for their staff. Was it because without their abbot in charge, the sub-prior's new order of things made it easy for them to do so? It certainly seemed it. Brother Adam de Warfield, the sacristan, for example, had at least six pages in his retinue about whom all kinds of rumours of criminality were swarming around. Now, such a situation clearly had caused ripples and, as we said, rumours of illegality. As mentioned, there had already been cases of sacrilegious theft, like someone stole hundreds of pounds worth in silver intended for masses for the repose of the late Queen Eleanor. In truth, despite the high walls around it, the Abbey grounds were often busier than the Great October Fair, with comings and goings of a wide variety of people, including carpenters and masons working on the chapel of St. Stephen or repairing things in the Abbey during the day, and other, not exactly sure what they're doing here, people who visited at night. And yet, to finally understand the true reason why the robbery took place in 1303, we actually have to look next door, to the final part of Westminster, next to the abbey, separated by its own high wall, with the towers and turrets and the great hall of Westminster Palace, just a short walk across the monastic enclosure. And yet, when the robbery took place, Westminster Palace was in a very odd position. If the Abbey of Westminster was being run by monks with a virtual absentee abbot who was away spending money and spending time with his attractive young female cousin, and being run by a sub-prior who liked to hang out with seedy types when the robbery took place, the palace at this exact moment was a ghost town. The Lords of England, the great ones, the movers and shakers who worked in the royal palace and hall, as well as the nearby Exchequer and Chancery buildings, they had all moved to York. To focus on his war with Scotland, King Edward had basically moved the entire apparatus of royal government up north, and his eyes, heart, and full weight of his being was now determined to conquer Scotland. Now, in ordinary circumstances, with the king being away, governance of the palace would be overseen by the keeper of the palace, a man called John Senchi, who had inherited that title, the keeper of the palace, through his wife, Joan. However, John Senchi too was an absentee official, leaving the actual protection of the palace to his lieutenant, William Palmer. And William Palmer was very, very friendly with the leading monks of the abbey, organising special parties for sub-prior Alexander de Penshaw and others who, quote, within the gardens of that palace, played, ate and drank with women of bad reputation about which they were reproved by their prior, unquote. Intimate, illicit relationships developed between those supposedly celibate monks and the ladies of the town. the sacristan of Westminster, John de Warfield, was rumoured to have offered the daughter of a man called William Russell a bracelet and a gold ring so that she would become his friend. Such stories of such salacious behaviour were spreading. They could not be ignored, nor could the likes of people like John Rippingale, John de Ritchie and other undesirables roaming the palace and the abbey whenever and wherever they wished. That William Palmer, or William of the Palace as he was known, was deputy keeper of the Fleet Prison in the City of London as well, meant that he also enjoyed close links with the villains of London's underworld. As if the Abbey did not have enough problems with his own sanctuary men. And William Palmer ultimately was hardly fit company for a bunch of Benedictine monks. He had left his own wife and openly consorted with a prostitute called Edlina, who was the daughter of Nicholas the Cook, a member of whose family had been imprisoned in Newgate Prison some years earlier for attempting to rob the royal treasury. As the investigation into the robbery started, stories emerged of just how bad things had been under Alexander de Penshaw. Stories how, like, 3 years earlier, in 1300, there had been an attempt to breach the crypt. The abbot had gone to the king and had apologised and hushed the matter up. But he couldn't do that this time. During May and June 1303, items from the royal treasury had been found in the cemetery and in the wasteland around the abbey. The coroner of Westminster, a man called Henry de Chering, had even come to investigate these finds. But no sooner had he arrived in the early spring, when sub-prior Alexander de Penshaw and sacristan Adam de Warfield had expelled him from the site, shut the abbey off, closed its gates and doors, and refused admission to anyone who they said had no right to enter. St. Peter's Abbey in Westminster was part of the church, and under church law, he had no authority here. And in many ways, the abbey was entirely correct. The coroner of Westminster had no authority within abbey grounds. But the king knew that, which is why that terrible letter had been addressed to his people in Westminster. And here we encounter the principal hunter of the perpetuators of this crime, the king's chief investigator, John de Drockensford. Drockensford recognised that King Edward's anger at the news of his treasury at Westminster being violated would be endless. Drockensford became the chief investigator after that letter arrived from the king, and he received it and left Westminster and slipped into London like a thief in the night to take counsel with the justices appointed by the king who had left there. Ralph de Sandwich, constable of the Tower of London and the former warden of the entire city. John de Bakewell, who I'll talk about next episode. Walter of Gloucester and Richard de Southcote. All five of these men knew that the king's fury would be boundless, and so they agreed that their response had to be organised, brutal and effective. Plans had to be made. Drockensford was aware of London's mostly hostile attitudes to the king and more conscious of the Abbey of Westminster's traditional rights. Of course he'd know about that. Drockensford's main office adjoined the abbey whilst he was directly responsible for the treasury. As well as that, Drockensford, as I said, owned property in Westminster, and he actually was on cordial terms with Abbot Walter Wenlock. Drockensford's family had held 90 acres of land in Hendon from the Abbey of Westminster. Abbot Walter had hired Drockensford as a legal counsellor, paying him a retainer of £25 sterling 7 years before the robbery, and only 4 years before the robbery. Drockensford had been the abbot's favoured guest at a splendid meal where he'd been royally entertained by specially hired minstrels. Nevertheless, such favour and friendship had to be forgotten. The king's business was paramount. Edward I had chosen his hunter well. Drockensford, for all his city connections, was not a Londoner. He was not tainted with the seedy politics of that city. He was the king's man, body and soul, to serve him both in peace and war, and he had served him in war. Drakensford had been promoted by the crown so that his loyalty was solely to the king. He owned everything to royal favour. Drakensford emerges from the pages of history as a very loyal, highly efficient, dogged and effective official, an ideal choice to hunt down the criminals who had ransacked the royal treasury, seize them as well as recover the king's possessions and seize whoever had got hold of it. Drakensford had a keen mind. He must have studied law. He became so skilled in it that several leading families hired him as their attorney. This being said, Drakensford's real genius was finance. In 1286, while he was serving with the English army in Gascony, Drakensford had first entered the Byzantine financial world of Edward I. He had at first served as a simple clerk of the exchequer, but his skill was soon noticed, and Drakensford was quickly introduced to the subtle intricacies of King Edward I's developing financial system. By 1290, the exchequer still controlled the kingdom's finances under its treasurer, Walter Langton. The exchequer supervised expenditure and receipt of taxes. They received the dues for the crown, and they audited the sheriff's accounts four times a year. However, the king was the centre of government, and where he went, the administration followed, so that his needs and those of his vast household led to the emergence of another prominent office of state, the royal wardrobe, which financed the king in war and peace. The wardrobe covered all the varying accounts of the different households of the king, the queen, the Prince of Wales. They covered the costs of gifts, messengers, day-to-day expenses, as well as the costs of all foreign and military activity. Drakensford also proved he had a flair for such administration, being appointed cofferer, then controller, and finally in November 1295, keeper of the wardrobe, a post he'd occupy for the next 12 years. Drakensford was well paid for such a high office, but it let him understand something overlooked about this robbery. While most of the king's money came from taxes upon the English peoples, he needed quite a few short-term loans, especially from Italian financiers to cover day-to-day expenses and shortfalls. And that was fine. After all, he could always just get such loans because he always had collateral to use as a surety. And that surety and collateral was the contents of the great treasury. That robbery had not only inflicted a humiliating dent into royal pride, it also possibly could make a rather hefty dent into the royal pocket. Drakensford needed to act, and act fast, and act smart. And he did. He wrote up a public proclamation to be issued in London. But the smart thing he did was he didn't issue it in his name. Rather, Drakensford got the mayor of London to issue the command, which said, quote, "We do command you, on behalf of our lord the king, upon forfeiture of life and of limb and of lands, of chattel, and whatsoever else you may forfeit, that all those who found any of the treasure of our lord the king, be it gold or silver or precious stone or anything whatsoever, whether within the city or without it, in whatsoever place it may be, coming from his treasury at Westminster, which has been broken into, such a person shall come into the Guildhall before the mayor and the sheriffs and restore what they have found between this and Sunday next by the hours of Vespers. We do also command, on behalf of his lord our king, that all those who have sold or bought any of the said treasure, or know any persons who have sold and bought any of the said treasure, or know any persons who found any part of the said treasure, or have the same in their keeping in any manner whatsoever, shall come into the Guildhall before the mayor and the sheriffs, and shall show and acknowledge what they know about it between this and the Sunday next at the hour of Vespers, in the manner as it was before stated. Whosoever shall not do this honour before such a day, the king will hold them as felons, unquote. Now this was actually a brilliantly worded piece of bait. First of all, it was offering an amnesty, seemingly, to everybody who showed up and, well, confessed. But crucially, no mention was made of the fact that Drachenfels and the royal justices were heading up the investigation. Oh, no, no, no. When you read it, or you heard it read, this looked like it was a London affair, with local London officials, the mayor and the sheriffs, being in charge of this investigation. Anyone who heard this proclamation would think, ah, just the local boys in charge. That was an intentional ruse. Now, the proclamation was issued on Sunday the 16th of June 1303. Like any hunter, Drachenfels and his colleagues hoped to flush someone or something out into the open. They were not to be disappointed. As we will see, some of the culprits did panic and hastily move treasure, which brought them to the attention of other people. However, Drachenfels was rewarded by an even greater prize. For on the day following that proclamation, William Palmer, deputy keeper of the palace, appeared in the guild hall and said he wanted to confess. Wait, what? The treasury had been robbed by the deputy keeper of the palace? But for reasons that will become clear, his confession, he thought, was a great idea. The confession, written in Norman French, reads as follows. Quote, on Monday, the feast of St. Budulph, the 17th of June, William Palmer, valet of John Senchi, keeper of the palace, came into the presence of Ralph de Sandwich, John LeBlund, the mayor of London, John Cleacott, the coroner of London, and Simon de Paris, sheriff of London. He claimed that Adam de Warfield, Alexander de Persia, Thomas de Dean, and John Butterley, and a certain novice who had lately arrived and had been ordained for that chapel, but his name he was ignorant, as well as John of St. Albans the Mason, and a certain John, his valet, and William, valet of Dominus Arnold de Champagne, as well as a certain valet from Essex who had returned into the city of London, whose name he did not know, together with John, son of Geoffrey the Carpenter, and Roger de Wenlock, valet of the sacristan, and Roger de Prestock, who works in the cellar at the abbey. Together with John de Charing, John de Notley, John de Prescott, and Thomas de Lichfield, all knew and were consenting to the burglary. William said that the sacristan, Adam de Warfield, had given him 10 shillings through John of St. Albans that he might keep their plan secret, unquote. This betrayal, this news was startling. Here, William de Palmer was indicting leading members of the Abbey of Westminster of being behind this entire robbery. I mean, besides Alexander de Persia, the subprior, John de Buttery was also a friend of Abbot Wenlock. He made payments on behalf of him going back years. Buttery was steward of the abbot's household and keeper of the chapel of Our Lady in the abbey, a rich source of funds. Adam de Warfield had also been in the abbey some years, acting on behalf of Abbot Wenlock. He too had served as the abbot's steward and acted as his attorney in dealing with property belonging to the abbey. Adam de Wenfield, on February 24, 1303, had been appointed as sacristan, a powerful position in the monastic community because he had access to the abbey treasury as well as other precious goods owned by the Benedictines. More importantly, Adam de Warfield, as sacristan, was responsible for the security of the abbey. Meanwhile, included in the list of those being named, a monk called Thomas de Dean, who had been Abbot Wenlock's keeper of the larder and had also then become the treasurer. John de Notley was a monk who had witnessed a charter at Westminster back in 1297. Roger de Charing was probably a young monk, as was Thomas de Lichfield. All the others named were valets or servants in the abbey. But it is interesting to note, as early as this first confession, craftsmen working with the abbey or the palace precincts were also named. John Alban, or John of St. Albans, a mason working in the abbey, is reported as having played a prominent part in the burglary. Whew! At first glance, it would seem that William Palmer had panicked about him knowing part of this and wished to protect himself by turning state evidence against these monks. And all that happened was he'd heard about it and accepted 10 shillings not to tell anybody, but felt guilty and then spilled the beans. However, a closer study of his confession demonstrates William was trying to be cunning, not so much in what he said, but what he did not say. He doesn't actually blame the monks for breaking in or doing the robbery. He just said they were consenting to it. There's no reference as to who actually carried out the crime, except that beside the monks, certain valets and two craftsmen, a mason and a carpenter, who were simply involved in consenting of it. William of the Palace appears to be playing up the fact that Westminster Abbey was strictly off-limits to the law officers of the city and throwing them a bone. The monks could refuse entrance to them if they turned up, citing church authority. They themselves could claim the benefit of the clergy, so they could not be tried by any secular court, whilst the likes of the mason, John of St. Albans, together with Geoffrey the carpenter, they could seek sanctuary in the abbey grounds. William was perhaps hoping that the prospect of invading the abbey would cause significant delay, or indeed block any progress at all. After all, the coroner of Westminster, Henry de Chering, had already been kicked out of the abbey. Why should it be any different again? Criminals often display arrogance, and William of the Palace certainly did right now. But ultimately, he'd been tricked by that proclamation. The proclamation, as I said, talks only of London officers waiting at the Guildhall for evidence to be presented. When William of the Palace appeared before them on the 17th of June, he had totally underestimated the opposition facing him, particularly Drockensford, who immediately seized upon this information being supplied and took decisive action. See, Drockenfeld was able to gain from William's confession a chronology, a context for the robbery, and this illuminated things for him. The treasury was broken into and robbed between Tuesday the 30th of April and Friday the 3rd of May in 1303. From evidence later submitted, it appeared that rumours of the crime were rife in or around Sunday the 25th of May. That was weeks later. As word had gotten out, those involved had begun to panic and were beginning to move treasure from Westminster along the river to the fields in Kentish Town. This had caused the coroner of Westminster to be alerted. There was also considerable evidence that information was being supplied by monks living in the abbey who were not part of the wayward lot but were actually genuine Benedictine monks, and who were sickened about everything they were seeing and hearing going on about them. Around the 28th of May, someone sent word to the king. The robbers, of course, realised that the crime had been detected but were confident that their privileged status would keep them safe. On June the 6th, Edward I responded. His letter would have reached London by Friday the 14th at the latest. Once Drockensfeld and his colleagues received the royal writ, they issued that proclamation on Sunday the 16th. William Palmer's confession came on the 17th of June. And then, the next morning, Drockensfeld and the royal justices arrived at Westminster Abbey like God's avenging angels. What followed was known as the Dies Irae, the Day of Anger. Their military escort ringed the abbey with a circle of steel, and the king's men went to work. Drockensfeld and his colleagues carried out a thorough search of the abbey and its grounds. They went into the wasteland and cemetery around the crypt. They inspected the hemp, long and thickly clustered, sprouting around the windows of the crypt where the robbery had taken place. They soon established it had been sown deliberately to conceal the robbers' handiwork. Therefore, the crime had been planned for some time. Afterwards, they scoured the entire ground. One of the justices, Walter of Gloucester, actually discovered precious items in the cemetery grass, which he handed over to Drockensfeld. The sanctuary containing the treasury was investigated. They found where the robbers had entered. They searched the outer buildings of the complex of the abbey, which accounts for the line from one of the indictments that a certain John the Priest, or the chaplain, had been captured and detained in the grounds of the abbey. This defrocked priest was John de Rippenhill, who was immediately lodged in the abbey prison above the gatehouse at Westminster. Drockensfeld carried out a similar search in the abbey itself, despite protests from some of the monks, and later evidence suggests that the royal clerk did not hesitate at using violence. The prior at the time of the robbery was William de Huntingdon, the non-entity who had lost control of the abbey to Alexander de Penshaw. The prior was present when Drachenfeld arrived, and apparently he refused in principle to allow Drachenfeld enter his room, so he basically broke down the door to carry out his search for evidence and stolen treasure. Some of the monks certainly resisted, which led to more doors being kicked in and more chambers being searched. Stolen items were found in private chambers, including two expensive silver chalices. It would appear, to all accounts, that the abbey was ringed off and raided, chambers broken into, grounds were searched, and sacristan Warfield and others closely questioned. Any talk about the church's rights were utterly ignored. According to the list of prisoners drawn up in July and August 1303, 10 monks from Westminster Abbey, along with others, were now escorted and dumped into the Tower of London. Adam de Warfield, Alexander de Pershaw, Thomas de Dean, Robert de Channing, John de Notley, John de Prescott, Thomas de Lichfield, and John Buttery. In time, two more joined them, Ralph de Morton the Cellarer and Roger de Bruys. Undoubtedly, these 10 detentions were due to the searches Drachenfeld carried out, as well as his questioning of the Benedictines at Westminster. And in doing this, he'd truly breached the only defence any of these robbers could have had. They'd put their trust into the rights of the abbey, the independence and clerical status of its community. Yet this had been totally ignored, and would be for the next 10 months or so. Drachenfeld and his colleagues interrogated the monks and clearly terrified them, and obtained the names and whereabouts of their principal criminal associates in London. And this led to the lightning arrests of a man called Richard de Padlicott, together with the principal fence of all this treasure, John of Newmarket, sometime during Tuesday the 18th and Wednesday the 19th of June, 1303. They were seized in their homes in possession of stolen items. John of St. Albans, a mason, was also arrested over these days. Stolen items began to be rounded up. Jewellery and items were beginning to be found. There was a massive clampdown, and it seemed to be working. All we have to understand is that by the 20th of June, 1303, Drachenfeld knew the full extent of the damage and robbery. He'd contained it, and he'd reimposed order. Now he had at least a dozen men in the Tower of London, and he was searching for the rest of the treasure and bringing to justice anybody responsible for stealing it, and was now beginning to look for those who were responsible for handling it after the crime. And it's at this point that we now bring London into the mix. This is a city that only 5 years previously had regained its independence from being ruled directly by the crown. And whilst this robbery had nothing to do with the city, as you know, Westminster was not London, this was instantly a big political problem. King Edward was bulldozing everything in his pass. It was clear he was taking this robbery personally. And no matter what anybody said, they'd just worked out that between the robbery itself and the ferocious raid of the king's investigator, there'd been a delay of weeks. Weeks where knowledge of this crime must have been known by someone, where incredibly expensive items must have been fenced, where some people were buying this, where the authorities must have heard something, but no one had said a damn thing. What the hell had London been doing whilst the greatest robbery in English history was being carried out and its proceeds were being apparently spread around the city? London well knew from the events we covered back in chapter 97. When Edward took things personally, he would stop at nothing to go after those people responsible. London and its mayor knew better than anyone else in the kingdom just how much of a shitstorm was coming. And as such, London, and its mayor and the whole of the city's officials knew they had to get their asses out of the firing line and make sure that if any of those questions implicated the city, they just needed to remove the answers. And we're going to cover that in part two of the Westminster Job, The Great Cover-Up. Okay, so I'm going to be trying to produce, it may come out this week, it may come out next week, part two of this one. This one does go on. I'll also be citing the amazing book that was the source of this and a whole load of other things in the next chapter. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back as soon as I can with another chapter in the story of London. Thanks.